Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show, of course, is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And like all of the shows, all the podcasts here at WFYI, they are available on Spotify. A little extra intro today. That is, of course, the theme from Enter the Dragon, music by Lalo Schifrin. It's a big movie week. It was a big movie week at the Soucy House because of the release on Criterion of the 7-disc box set, Bruce Lee, His Greatest Hits. And we'll get to that in a little bit. And, of course, grab a pencil afterwards and we'll hear what I'll read off what you've been watching over this past week. But I want to start with a couple of film, couple of new films that came out. And man, it was a busy day on the day that I watched this particular set of films. But and I'll try to do them in chronological order. But opening this weekend, courtesy of IFC Films, is the drama The Painted Bird, a almost 3-hour black and white drama set in a Eastern European country. We're never told exactly what it is, during World War II, and it follows the plight. Dickens would have said this kid went through too much. His parents leave him with a relative who dies, the house burns down, and this sad young boy, and kudos to the young actor who has to endure being in just about in every frame of this film. Going from one misadventure, and that shouldn't say misadventure, but going from one household to another with just a myriad of horrible things happening to him, and that is not involved, and not all of these involve the Nazi Party. This is a film that, and I know it's based on a very controversial Polish novel. The author said it was initially back in the 60s was autobiographical. It was later proven that that was false. But man, this was a tough ride to watch. Beatings, mutilation, not all of it happening to this kid. Sodomy, bad things, just shootings. It is a rough ride. Like I said, almost 3 hours long, and it's a film. And I've liked the jerking around of filmmakers like Lars von Trier, but this is a film that rides that line. On, are we trying to show the randomness of what happens in life? And also, it just feels like the writer and director is just kind of jerking your chain quite a bit. And it feels like a chain jerking. I think if Stacey Studeville was here, she would say, bleep that guy. So anyway, it's not for everybody. You see some familiar faces. It's almost a silent movie as well. Very minimal dialogue in this film. But you see familiar faces like Udo Kerr, who has and usually like one sequence and that's about it. He plays a very jealous husband who beats his wife when he thinks that she's looking at something else. Takes the man who he thinks is the object of his wife's affections and cuts out his eyes with a spoon. Yeah. Artistically done. You also see familiar faces like Stellan Skarsgård, Barry Pepper, Harvey Keitel. It looks great. Beautiful black and white photography. Beautiful footage of the European countryside. But man, it is a slug to get through. And probably, especially in the last few months since we've been cooped up, probably not the best choice. So I've warned you, if you're into pushing the boundaries, I don't think it's a great film. It's well made, but it's really well made. I just don't think I can sit through it again. And kudos to the young man who plays the lead in this. Looking for something shorter and lighter, but not that light, is the Australian melodrama Dirt Music. And this features Kelly MacDonald, who we all know for everything from Brave and No Country for Old Men, among others. She is a single mom with a fisherman boyfriend in Western Australia. The relationship is stuck. She meets a younger guy played by Garrett Hedlund, who's also a poacher of her boyfriend's fishing area. And what happens when that triangle becomes a little twisted? The Garrett Hedlund character Lou was a musician. The film plays quite a bit with flashbacks, and you see quite a number of as the film goes on, you learn more about Lou's character. He has lost his family, who keeps popping up as if they are still there in his mind, and they kind of dip into that well a little too much for my taste. So, and I'm not saying that you should pay attention more. I just say this is one you don't want to fold laundry to. You actually want to pay attention to what's going on. But even that aspect of it, I think it dips in too much. Nice performances and nice chemistry between MacDonald and Hedlund. And it does follow the and I use the term melodrama. It is not a bad term. This is not a dig on. This is what the film is about love and love lost and two people hopefully getting together and they just miss it. And that covers the dots. And there's gorgeous countryside of Western Australia. But the trope of flashbacks emerging in front of you, just like I said, one too many times for my taste. So anyway, I watched those back to back. And we'll get to the Bruce Lee box set in a little bit, but I'll get through what else I watched this week. Last Friday, I got home early, thank goodness, and Emma and I had a triple feature. She had never seen Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette, and she liked that very much, as do I. I know Sofia Coppola got raked over the coals a little bit about this. It's not the first time we've had a period piece film with, in this case, 80s music. I would say if you're an art house fan, you like Marie Antoinette. If you're a multiplex crowd, you liked A Knight's Tale. Same method as far as period film, modern music. So anyway, we watched that. I had watched this, I think it was earlier this year, because there was a Kirsten Dunst Blu-ray double feature, that and the 1994 Little Women. We revisited Robots at my daughter's expense. My Emma loves this film and does not care what anybody says. This was one that she latched onto at a very young age. Watching it, I think what bugged me was there early on was I grew very weary of animated films that had to have pop culture references, and I'm Mr. Pop Culture Reference, but a robot dancing to Britney Spears and a bunch of robots dancing to James Brown at the end, it's kind of low hanging fruit for my taste. It still looks cool, and Emma loves the voice. I mean, it's a strong list of voice actors: Ewan McGregor, Greg Kinnear, Halle Berry, Robin Williams, Jim Broadbent, and it's one of those. I think it's also, no matter what Robin Williams did, animated wise, it was never going to match Aladdin. And I know he did other animated films. That he did this, and of course, most notably, Happy Feet. But does not even come close. But it does look cool, and I got some dad daughter time. And I occasionally try to do old movie night on Fridays, whether my family jumps on it with me or not. And I kind of just pulled an audible for the Friday night choice, and I picked Charlie Chaplin's The Kid. I forgot that it was only under an hour, and but it's still a lovely film to watch, and great chemistry between Coogan and Chaplin. So that was last Friday. as I was going through, and like I said, I'll get to the Bruce Lee box set a little bit, but there was as I'm going through my notes, there was a day where at the household where all three of us, especially Emma and I, were stressed out, not at each other, but we had had stressful days, and we had talked about, you know, we were constantly talking about films and or artists, and because of The West Wing, Emma really liked Janine Garofalo. And she knew of Garofalo's voice from Ratatouille, but this was her first time seeing it. And I had brought up, so I got to show my daughter, because we needed it, The Truth About Cats and Dogs. When Uma Thurman is playing the sidekick and Janine Garofalo is your lead. But still enjoy it. And this was one that my buddy Laura Jansen and I watched when we were both in the Chicago suburbs. And it's fun at a point. There's certain films now that my daughter will see a certain character or a certain behavior and point and say, that's you. And there's a couple guys that respond to Uma Thurman like her father probably would. So anyway, got to revisit that. And with that in mind, last night, as a palate cleanser after a harsh Polish film and a Australian melodrama, we did a double feature of Reality Bites and Summer School. Now, Reality Bites also has, that's of course, Ben Stiller's directing film, who he also appears in it. It's a 90s slacker screwball comedy with Winona Ryder torn between friend and Mr. Cool Guy Ethan Hawke and businessman Ben Stiller. Janine Garofalo, Steve Zahn are also in this. And this was a film that my buddy Laura and I reconnected with because we didn't have films to talk. We didn't have anybody to talk about movies with. And anyway, so that always holds a special place, and it still holds up. It's I was concerned that I would reach an age where 20 somethings who are trying to move on in life. Probably didn't resonate with me, although this one did. I remember not being a fan of St. Elmo's Fire in my teens, not being a fan of Slacker when Richard Linklater's film, when that came out. But this one, I think it's more of a screwball comedy than a Slacker film. It just happens to have the 90s grooming and costumes. So anyway, that worked out well. And then Summer School. And I wanted to watch this earlier because of Carl Reiner, who directed Summer School, who had passed away, of course. And this was a film. This was the first big film starring Mark Harmon, who had already done TV. And there was a brief stretch where he was starring in films. And he plays a gym teacher who's forced to teach summer school. And this came out in the summer of 87, and it has a special. This is another film that has a special place in my heart because my dear darling friend Quentin, who I met that summer at the International Thespian Conference at Ball State, my buddy Jason Beckman and I kind of fawned over her the way Chainsaw and Dave fawn over Anna Maria, and so nicknames were born. And so anyway, I think of Quentin and I think of my buddy Jason when I watch this film. Revisiting it with Emma, she liked it, and not just because she liked to look at 80s Mark Harmon, but it was one of those that it was a little bawdier than your average John Hughes film, but not as raunchy as the R-rated horny teenager films of the 80s, like Porky's and Hard Bodies. So it just kind of hit that sweet spot. You have Emma got introduced to young versions of Kirstie Alley, Courtney Thorne Smith, Shawnee Smith, and Mark Harmon, of course. So that was enjoyable. So we had a good day on that. Okay, so the Criterion Collection put out a 7-disc collection called Bruce Lee: His Greatest Hits. Now, as it was at the beginning of the pandemic when this was announced that they were going to release it. And there's a fun thing happening to me all summer long. So I really, really wanted to get this. I grew up on the Bruce Lee films, and the fact that Criterion was going to give it the treatment, which means it was going to be chock full of goodies and it was going to look good and it was going to sound good. And I produce a podcast when I'm not here at WFYI. It's called Taking Care in Business. Hello, ladies. And anyway, the check for that podcast had arrived at the right time. So the combination of that check arriving and the fact that Criterion – oh, and by the way, Barnes & Noble are doing a half-off Criterion throughout the rest of the month of July. There you go. But Criterion put out a half-off special, and I purchased the Bruce Lee box set. Very excited. It wasn't coming out until, well, I was, July 14th was the release date. And so I pre-ordered, and I kept – they don't take your money right away. I was ready for them to take my money. They kind of shut up and take my money. I had to do checkbook math all summer – until and I wondered if there was going to be a delay or if it was going to be take long because I had ordered some Mystery Science Theater box sets from Shout Factory, and that took it normally took I think 7 business days or and then they pushed it to 14 business days and eventually I got an email a mass email or a generic email that that Shout Factory sends out to people who order say sorry for the delay. Thank you for your patience. And the stuff did arrive. But I kept waiting and waiting. And then finally, about a week and a half ago, got a confirmation email and they took my money. But I was ready for them to take my money immediately because I trust them. So anyway, if you're listening, Criterion, thank you. But yeah, you could take my money sooner if you'd like. And I never thought I'd say that. Okay. So this is a 7-disc collection. And you can go to the Film Yap to read my review of this box set. But I grew up in the time when there were kung fu movie shows on television where you'd get the badly dubbed films that were not starring Bruce Lee. They started the ones that the Bruceploitation films were quite a bit of them. But as I was revisiting these films, the four films that were completed and then the botched job that is Game of Death, which I'll get to in a moment, I realized that James Dean had his 3 films. John Cazale had his 5 films. All of them, by the way, Best Picture nominees or winners. That's a great stat and a great piece of trivia. And Bruce Lee had done a whole lot. If you get a chance, check out the ESPN document, 30 for 30 documentary about Lee called Be Water. I forgot to do that in the Film Yap write-up, but it's worth checking out because it's about him going back to Hong Kong after trying to make it in Hollywood. You know, Lee had a tough time in Hollywood in the 60s. Yes, he got to play Kato in The Green Hornet, but they canceled it after 1 year. And he tried to he developed the series Kung Fu, and the studio gave it to David Carradine because they didn't think an Asian person could star in a TV show. And he had one good scene in Marlowe and one not so good scene. But so it frustrated. He had a lot of walls that he couldn't break through at that time. So he goes back to Asia, goes back to Hong Kong, and signs with Golden Harvest, which had just come an offshoot of the Shaw Brothers. And comes up with The Big Boss in 1971. So that's where we start. And like I jokingly said to Chris Lloyd, I'm going to review each disc individually as opposed to reviewing all the discs at once because that's a complaint people have about martial art films. They only attack you one at a time. But The Big Boss is the story of Bruce Lee's character who gets a job at an ice factory that we find out has shady business practices. They are selling heroin in their blocks of ice, which is interesting because ice is clear. So you could see the stuff that they're the nefarious items that they are selling through their ice. And as certain workers start to ask questions, they wind up getting killed and buried in the ice as well. So that's not the most perfect thing. What's interesting watching the story is that Lee's character shows up and doesn't fight until about halfway through the film. And I think what happened, it was director Lo Wei who it was the gentleman at the beginning of the film who does a lot of the fighting. Lee's character comes to town and has a jade necklace, and he made a vow to his family that he would never fight. And they don't quite get into why, but that's just how it is. So the first half of the film, another guy does the fighting when the thugs for the boss of the company is coming to lean on employees and what have you. By the way, it's James Tien who plays the guy who does a lot of fighting at the beginning. And finally, when a busload of thugs arrive to beat up some of the workers, somebody bumps into Lee and breaks his necklace, and he cannot stand it no more. And it basically, Lee's character takes over the second half of the film. And that was kind of a move done by Lo Wei. And James Tien wound up appearing in a couple other Lee films. But this becomes the turning point. So the fight scenes with Lee are great. Now, he didn't get to direct his fight scenes in this. He would have more of a pull in his other films, which we'll get to in a bit. But yeah, once Lee is able to start to kick butt and take names, it's really exciting stuff. It's not entirely perfect on the set. You also have a romantic subplot Lee doesn't get to be intimate enough with his leading ladies. I think that's obviously we're going to see these films for fights as opposed to love. But there's also things like a groin punch backed up by the sound of a kettle drum, which happens quite a bit in these films in the 70s. But it's a really fun start. This became head and tails above the other martial art films that were going on at the time, made Lee immediately a star in Asia. So that's 1971. A year later, he teams up with Lo Wei again for Fist of Fury. So a clarification. So initially, when The Big Boss was released in the United States, it was released as Fists of Fury, plural. And then Fist of Fury, singular, was released as The Chinese Connection. I got to see both of these films in the theater as a double bill with my dad when I was in, I believe, middle school. And I was always confused because The Big Boss is the one that has the heroin dealing through the ice factory. I thought that should have been named The Chinese Connection because of the play on the words, the play on title of The French Connection. But I didn't make the titles. That just happened. In Fist of Fury, our hero, played by Lee, comes back to his hometown and his studio where his master teacher has died. And as soon as the teacher master has died, rival gangs start to come and harass the school, including obligatory skinny, glasses-wearing, feminine-acting lechy guy. So, and this guy shows up in a couple other films. And there's more fights in this film from Lee. There's more and also use of weapons. It's a little bloodier. It's a little more violent, I think, than The Big Boss. You do have more blood, more of the Bruce Lee token cries and shrieks. You also have the obligatory close-ups and zooms, and as I'm going through my notes, swords versus nunchucks. So there's also a really cool Butch Cassidy moment at the end of the film. So the other thing about this collection, and I'm happy to say, and there have been a myriad of video releases for these films, but this is the first time I got to watch The Big Boss, Fist of Fury, and The Way of the Dragon, which I'll get to in a moment, subtitled, not dubbed. And dubbing of kung fu films is something we've been joking about for decades. I remember joking about it as a teenager and thinking I was the first one to come up with these. Everybody does. Every generation thinks that. And those who really complain about reading subtitles, you need to get over yourself. But there is a mental difference between hearing a native language speaking or then overdubbing. So, and I was really excited that this was a first for me, that I got to experience these films with fresh eyes and fresh ears. Each film in this collection has a 4K restoration, except for Enter the Dragon, which has a 2K. So, interesting to watch these. They look really good by comparison. It's not Apocalypse Now or The Godfather, but if you watch these special features on these films, you also see the trailers. And you can see how, because these were prints that had been dragged from city to city, country to country, and Criterion does a really nice job of cleaning these films up. So anyway, that is out there. Third film, Way of the Dragon. This time around, Bruce Lee gets to write and direct, as well as star in this. And this is, we've had the, you know, the shady business films. We've had the Avenge the Master's Death films, and now this one. And then I think many films owe this plot to The Way of the Dragon. One that comes to mind immediately is Rumble in the Bronx, where a cousin travels from Hong Kong to Rome to help out at his cousin's restaurant that is being overridden by bad guys. There are baddies everywhere just coming and beating and tearing things up. So Lee wanted to make what he called a spaghetti Eastern. He wanted to take this was the first Hong Kong film shot on location in Rome. So you get the footage of the Italian countryside, or in this case, I should say the Italian city side. And this time around, Lee gets to play some comedy. I think we're kind of used to him as a stoic fighting machine, especially in something like Enter the Dragon. But in this one, he's more playful. As he arrives in Rome, there's a fish out of water tale. There's a great moment where he shows up to a restaurant and just kind of points at the menu. And then we find out he's accidentally ordered 4 bowls of soup. But he's going to eat his mistakes. It's like the first meal I ordered in Paris, where it didn't come exactly how I wanted it, but I was not going to return it. And so anyway, watching him mow down on 4 bowls of soup, that's fun. But he's more playful in this one. There's watching Lee do some light comedy in Way of the Dragon, and I forgot to mention, in Fist of Fury, he dons some disguises to get information about the rival studios that are leaning on his studio, the studio he used to work at, teach at, learn at. Anyway, but the fact that he got a chance to do some light comedy a little bit, obviously he died way too soon, and he's become one of the great what could have been in show business. He would have probably fared well if in the aging geezer action films when he was in his 60s and 70s. So anyway, the other thing about Way of the Dragon it's famous for is the final battle that takes place in the Roman Colosseum. They actually got a camera inside the Roman Colosseum, but the actual fight itself was on a studio stage. But Bruce Lee versus then movie unknown, but 7-time U.S. karate champion Chuck Norris. So watching these two battle it out is worth the price of admission alone. But it's also a really good film. But yeah, seeing Norris in a silent role as the bad guy, as the guy who he has to fight at the end, and no beard, because he has enough body hair to make a beard on Norris's face. And this is, like I said, before Norris launched his own film career. But two martial art gladiators fighting it out, and it's really, really well done. Then we get, of course, to Enter the Dragon. So His big break, which unfortunately he never got to see the riches of the success of Enter the Dragon. It is more of a Bond film than a martial arts film. It's a spy film that happens to have a lot of martial arts in it. But it still holds up. This film has a special place in my heart because I've grown up watching it as a kid. I made my wife watch it when we were dating. It was also the first R-rated film I had Emma watch. The story on that was she really enjoyed Kung Fu Panda, and then I later showed her Rumble in the Bronx, and my pop culture Atticus Finch got the worst of me, and I said, you have to watch Enter the Dragon. So anyway, it has been talked about multiple times, but and I know Warner Brothers, Robert Klaus and Raymond Chow, who they co-produced with Warner Brothers, and Fred Weintraub and Robert Klaus, the director, they paired Lee up with Jim Kelly, who would get his own film a year after this, Black Belt Jones, and John Saxon, who's been in a myriad of things. But this is really Lee's show. I think Lee was concerned about getting pegged as the sidekick or the third level guy with his American co-stars. And there's two versions of Enter the Dragon in this Criterion Collection. There is the 99-minute version, and then there's the special edition. This is also the one that's on the Warner Brothers collection, if you have that. That spouts a little more philosophy. So there's a little more of Lee's philosophy and attitudes about martial arts. It's not just about kicking ass and taking names. And I also want to make a special point. Speaking of aging fighters, the guy who plays Master Han was 60 when he fought Lee in his film. So he's still hoofing it out there into his 60s. That's, you know, salute to you, sir. But it's still my favorite martial arts film. I know my buddy Jenny would bring up Five Fingers of Death, and there's nothing wrong with that as well. So, yeah, Enter the Dragon still holds up. It's still great. And I also remember seeing it at midnight at the Music Box Theater in Chicago. I believe it was all guys in the audience, which makes sense. And, you know, we walked out of the theater about 1:40 in the morning, all doing the Bruce Lee's screams and all thinking that we could take down anybody one at a time, of course, not in a group. So this is followed by Game of Death. So the story on this is Lee wanted to make a film about a former martial arts champion who is nudged into pulling off a heist. His family is held captive, so he's forced to do this heist that lands at the climax of a pagoda, and he is forced to fight his way literally to the top to rescue his family. And it was supposed to be 10 levels. It turned out to be 5. And Lee started filming this before Enter the Dragon. So we got to see 3 levels. He filmed about almost 50 minutes of material, including the 3 fight scenes that Lee has with level 1, level 2, level 3, for lack of a better comparison. The most famous fight is him and his former real-life student, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And we'll get to that in a little bit. So as he was filming this, word got that he was able to make Enter the Dragon. So he shelved the project, made Enter the Dragon, and after Enter the Dragon, I think it was a month before he died. In fact, the anniversary of his death is coming up next week, had his brain trauma and died. So between his death in 73 and this film's release, Game of Death in 78, a slew of what was called Bruceploitation films came out of the woodworks in Hollywood and in Asia. And there's a great documentary feature on the supplements of this collection talking about the Bruceploitation films, as well as a couple of Bruceploitation films, which I'll get to in a minute. Golden Harvest, who had put out the first 3 films, not Enter the Dragon, it seemed like for a long time they were not going to do this, they were not going to cash in on this, but they had the footage. And so finally, in 1978, Robert Klaus, the director, and Fred and Raymond Chow basically took Lee's footage, scrapped the story, and this time, and then brought in a myriad, I think it was 3 physical doubles, one that could do acting, one that could do fighting, and another one that could do stunts, if I remember right. This time around, Lee plays action star Billy Lowe, and he's filming footage that turns out to be the end of the fight scene from Way of the Dragon. And he's being harassed by the local syndicate. The local syndicate in Hong Kong is run by old Academy Award winner Dean Jagger and his one of his minions, a dangerous walking stick wielding Hugh O'Brien. Colleen Camp plays Billy's girlfriend. She's a singer. She's also she's basically the damsel in distress in this picture, and Gig Young, another Academy Award winner, also his final role before his tragic death, plays a newspaper reporter who's a friend of Billy and his girlfriend. So they use this footage at the very, very end. They actually wound up using 11 minutes of the 49, 50 minutes that Lee actually shot. As I mentioned, there's a lot of actors, 3 doubles that are backs to the camera or dark sunglasses, and there's even disguises, which we'll get to in a second. But probably the worst looking attempt is a scene early on where Hugh O'Brien is harassing the Billy character. And basically, they put a cardboard cutout of Lee's face on this actor's face. It looks really, really bad. And it got to a point where I think they just stopped trying to disguise the doubles that were playing Billy. But they still threw in reaction shots and secondary shots of Lee in other films, whether they matched or not. Most of the time, it doesn't. Colleen Camp does sing in this. In fact, at the beginning of the film, And the end of the film, it has a title sequence that looks like a James Bond film. And also, maybe help it does help that the score was done by John Barry, the man who did the James Bond theme. So that looked cool. And we'll get to the fight scenes in a little bit. But we get through a lot of disguises, and there's this ridiculous point of Billy's character is shot by an assassin who poses as an extra in the film that Billy is playing, acting in. They're recreating this end scene from Fist of Fury, the kind of Butch Cassidy Sundance Kid final image where he leaps in the air, freeze frame, and is riddled with gunfire. This moment has not aged well, especially because Bruce Lee's son Brandon died from an accidental shooting on the movie set of The Crow. So that just adds to the ickiness of watching watching Game of Death. Once we get to the fight scenes themselves, there are fight scenes throughout, and it's somebody else imitating Lee's screeches, which are not the same as Bruce Lee's actual screeches and noises. But once we get to the three levels of fighting, that's pretty cool, especially the one with him and Jabbar. The whole point of the pagoda thing was that you have to adapt to your fighting style to whoever you are fighting. And in this case, it's a 7-foot-tall basketball player who would later become a pilot in an airplane. As a younger person, I think I deemed this the worst film ever made because I was young and full of vinegar. Because of the treatment of the material, because of the disrespect of Lee, also the fact that after the Billy character gets shot in the face by this assassin, lives, they fake his death so he can put on a bunch of disguises and find out who his killers are. And they use actual funeral footage of Lee's funeral in Hong Kong. It leaves a bad taste. In the Bruce Playtation documentary, I believe, Grady Hendrix refers to Game of Death as tacky cinematic necrophilia. And he's not wrong. But it's not the worst film ever because of the 11 minutes of fight footage we actually see with Lee. And the John Barry score and the Bond opening and Colin Camp singing the song in the closing credits. So it actually resembles a legit film. It's just spoiled by all this stuff that happens throughout. So, and also the fact that there's a number of commentary tracks for each film, especially the gentleman who did the ones for Shout Factory for Game of Death, Fist of Fury, Chinese Connection, and Way of the Dragon. And as bad as the film is, it doesn't lower my opinion of the box set because I wanted to know more about how they pulled this off or why they pulled this off. I know why, but what they had to do in order to try to cobble together a Frankenstein monster of a film that is Game of Death. So Criterion does do that. It does show you what they had to go through to create this. So that's the four, that's the five. And then there were two extra discs of supplements. So, I'm that guy. I'm the guy that goes through all the special features. Because there's two commentary tracks on Big Boss, then talks about the several different cuts of the film and, the fact that you had it in English and Mandarin and Cantonese. That the commentary tracks were really good and fun and informative. But as I mentioned earlier, so the sixth disc has a couple of these Bruce Playtation films. So Game of Death comes out in 78. 3 years later, Golden Harvest puts out Game of Death 2, more from Raymond Chow, more Bruce Lee footage, and even footage of him from younger films when he was a child as well as a teenager. This was also known as Tower of Death. This also has the bad dubbing on it as well. This time around, Billy's brother comes into town to avenge his brother's death, and they show the funeral footage again. It's not cool. And the Billy character dies 35 minutes into the film, and then Billy's brother comes out, and then they make just another inexpensive kung fu film. The other one that came out, so you had the Bruceploitation films. You also had the Bruceploitation documentaries. And there was one from 1973 called Bruce Lee, The Man and the Legend. You have a narrator who sounds like he should be doing a Rankin Bass cartoon than actual news footage. And it's a slew of news footage of both funerals. There was one done in Hong Kong. There was also one in Seattle, which was his final resting place. So we get to see Linda and his children and the line of, the hordes of people that were outside. If you blink, you'll miss cameos of news footage of George Lazenby, James Coburn, Steve McQueen, Chuck Norris. A lot of footage that I think that the filmmakers begged, borrowed, and stole and didn't ask for anyone's permission. And that's the gist of Bruce Lee, The Man and the Legend. It's not fun. So we get that. And then we get into the Bruceploitation essay, which is done by Grady Hendrix, who I've seen do a number of these. And it's only 10 minutes. It could have gone an hour and a half. I would love to have heard more about these Bruceploitation films because some of them are pretty damn ridiculous. There's also an interview with Andre Morgan, who is one of the producers of Golden Harvest, the movie distribution company that put out the films I've already mentioned. I would love a full-length documentary about Golden Harvest. Bruceploitation I mentioned. There's also a cool interview with two English actors who were two of the guys that did the dubbing for the Kung Fu films in Hong Kong back in the 70s. It's a thing called Match the Lips. And then The Grandmaster and the Dragon. It was an interview with a gentleman who taught Lee early on as far as his style of martial arts. So I started it on Saturday night, late Saturday night, and I finished the collection. What was it? Wednesday evening, and wrote this up for the Film Yap on Thursday morning. So well worth it. This is what I've been waiting for all summer and enjoyed the hell out of it, and really worth it. And now I don't have to buy any more Bruce Lee films ever again. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Once again, kudos to the Criterion Collection for putting out the 7-disc collection Bruce Lee, His Greatest Hits. If you're a fan of action movies, especially martial art films, obviously this is a must grab. Watching this again, there was somebody that mentioned early on that an old producer in Hollywood back in the 60s didn't think martial art films would go over well in Hollywood because people fought like John Wayne. Well, how do they fight in The Matrix? They don't fight like John Wayne. They fight like Bruce Lee. And yes, if you're a fan of these films, especially Enter the Dragon, I also have to revisit A Fistful of Yen from Kentucky Fried Movie in 1978. You're welcome. All right. Grab a pencil. We're going to get to your stuff in a minute. But at the Tibbs Drive-In, in the ongoing attempt to get people to go to the drive-in by showing old movies, that would be the way I would want to go. If you show me some old titles, and some of them are. So at the Tibbs Drive-In, on screen one this weekend, The Muppet Movie, followed by Labyrinth. Brian, Monica, BB, there you go. Screen two, you have The Outpost, the new Rod Lurie film, followed by Followed. Screen three, they're showing both volumes of Kill Bill at the Tibbs Drive-In. And in screen four, you have Palm Springs and Relic, which I talked about on last week's show. Over at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville, you have The Muppet Movie and The Dark Crystal happening this weekend. Over at the Can-Can Cinema, you have at 8 o'clock on Friday night, the online screening and Q&A with the cast and writer and director of It's a Disaster, starring David Cross and Julia Stiles, director Todd Berger. There's a Sundance Masterclass on Monday, July 20th at 1 p.m., as well as a webinar from Sundance at 3 o'clock on Wednesday, July 22nd. And then Tuesday, July 28th, Visual Films and Conversations, Welcome to Chechnya at 7 p.m. You can go to cancanindie.com for all the information over there. And, of course, the Indie Shorts International Film Festival is happening now. You can go to heartlandfilm.org/indieshorts as far as tickets and all that information. I do want to give a shout-out to my buddy Selena Webb, also a graduate of the Ball State University and Barn Rats for Life. She has a film, along with Sammy Essex, written and directed, called Four Rows, which is a part of the festival. So congratulations, Selena and Samantha, for being a part of the Indie Shorts International Film Festival. Got to get you on the show sometime. Anyway, that is happening over there. All right, friends, grab a pencil. Let's see. Let's hear what you've been watching over the last week. We start, as always, via email by my buddy Eric, who's still going through season two of Mad Men. Tell Joan to call me. His rewatching this week was 1961's Mysterious Island, which he dubbed as good, as well as the 1953 film version of War of the Worlds, good plus, and the Criterion version of that, more good, actually wonderful, as he calls it. And Bye Bye Birdie from 1963, Tell Anne Margaret I Said Hello. All right, thanks there, Eric. Via Twitter, so Shirley Not Me says, Night Comes On. How had I not heard of it before? So simple, so good. Tracy Foreigner, who's been on the show, daughter and I watched Crimson Peak last night. Good call. That's Guillermo del Toro and Doug Jones, who's been on the show, and I need to revisit that with Emma as well. JD writes, Midsummer, not bad, but overly hyped online. Sure, I don't think so. Bill Reinhardt, who I got to get on the show as well. Force 10 from Navarone. Howard's Ghost says, Love Wedding Repeat. Watched this last night. Was pretty darn good. Crafty Jen writes, The original Footloose and the various works of Peter Cushing because Hulu said so. Yes. Essentially Not Essential, replies Greyhound. Darren Dixon, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Leslie writes, The Old Guard and Jess Mercy. So, and when I wrote that I was showing my daughter Reality Bites, Tracy Foreigner, always good for a line from a movie, asked me, what is your glitch? So, yeah, that's happening over, that was over on Twitter. On Facebook, here we go. Nick Rogers, who's been on this show, writes, Capone, The Grudge, that's the 2020 version, Palm Springs, Hard Boiled, The Half of It, and Bad Education from 2020. Jenny writes, The Old Guard. Jenny also writes, Fast Color. George writes, Lots of shorts on Dust, Great Sci-Fi, Beginner's Guide to Dating in a Parallel Universe, and Lovely Monster are a couple. Bonnie writes, The Old Guard and Cat Ballou. Devin writes, Elf. Joellen writes, Call Northside 777. Catherine writes, The Old Guard, Love Birds, and Stardust. Not Sawdust. Josh writes, The Taking of Pelham 123. Which one? As well as The Patriot. Megan writes, The Old Guard. Ed writes, Checked out Tom Hanks' new film on Apple Plus called Greyhound. Joe Shearer, been on this show before, The Beach House. You Cannot Kill David Arquette. Of course you watch that. The first two Die Hard films, Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street, Palm Springs, I Know What You Did Last Summer, Greyhound, Blood Quantum, Vivarium, Relic, A Perfect Host, Inheritance, John Lewis, Good Trouble, Bad Education, The Vast of Night, fell asleep during an early morning bloodshot yesterday, so I only saw about half of it, so it doesn't count yet. Well, we tell each other this. Lou writes, Lou Harry, Kate Ballard, The Show Goes On, and Gloria, A Life. I stuck to only those with colons in the title. Thank you, Lou. Nice colon. Carrie writes, What We Do in the Shadows and Moana. Michelle writes, Shakespeare in Love and Men in Black. Mark writes, The Mustang. Judy writes, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Darren writes, The Greatest Showman, Bye Bye Birdie, and Hamilton. Sam Watermeyer writes, To Die For and Red Dragon. Dustin writes, Thelonious Monk, Straight No Chaser. Way to go, Dustin. Selma, Straight Outta Compton, and We Are Your Friends. Nancy writes, so many. All of Me, No Country for Old Men, Stripes, Anti-Mame, Doctor Strangelove, and Jaws 2. Taylor writes, Point Blank, Dread, Harvey, After the Thin Man, Dogma, The List of Adrian Messenger, Batman, Mask of the Phantom, Sleepless in Seattle, Charlie Chan, The Trap, The Spy Who Dumped Me, Twins of Evil, Hammer Film, and GOG. Taylor, I own Twins of Evil on Blu-ray, so I'm glad you got that. Roxana writes, I watched an Angelica Houston movie I had never seen before, The Witches. What the holy hell was that? So bizarre. Yes, yes, Rox, it is. Marty writes, The Running Man. Eric writes, Starship Troopers, and V for Vendetta. Both were first-time views for me. Congratulations, Eric. Mary writes, The Original War of the Worlds. WFYI voice Abby Terzini writes, Airplane. Diana writes, The Old Guard. Paula writes, Mad Max Fury Road. Dave writes, What's Up, Doc? Why Him? And Clear and Present Danger. Rachel writes, Some Like It Hot, One Child Nation, Young Detective, D, The Rise of the Sea Dragon, and John Carter. Spencer writes, My son and I watched the god-awful recent Fantastic Four movie, which is just a mess. I told him about the 1990s Roger Corman version that was not released in theaters. We watched it on YouTube, and while the effects are laughable and the performances and dialogue textbook definitions are schlocky, of the four live-action Fantastic Four movies, it's the only one that shows respect for the original material. It respected the comic books. None of the others have. That is their failure. At times, especially when Dr. Doom's bumbling henchmen are on screen, it seems to be trying to match the tone of the 1976 Superman movie, 1979, which, until Tim Burton's Batman, was the only comic-related superhero movie to show any respect for the source material, including the three Superman sequels, which seem to purposely abandon all those things they had made in the first film successful. There you go, Spencer. Bill writes, The Bookshop with Emily Mortimer, Bill Nye, and Patricia Clarkson. Bill Nye was splendid. Bill, I'm glad you saw that one. I saw that when it came out, and not enough people have checked that out. Teresa writes, Legally Blonde, Little Darlings, you know, Wonder Woman, and Wet Hot American Summer. Kip writes, just two films, 1776 and Knives Out. Michael writes, The Monuments Men and A Mighty Wind. Melissa writes, It's a Disaster, The Lodge, What's Your Number? Duke writes, oh, funny, Watch Edge of Tomorrow, twice. Dave writes, Hannah and Her Sisters, I'll Give It a Meh. Okay. Higher than that. Patty writes, The Spider-Woman and Captain Blood. Don writes, Colossal, interesting little film with a unique premise. Agreed, Don. Tom writes, Pete Kelly's Blues. Daniel writes, The Big Sleep, I Was a Mail Order Bride, Ghostbreakers, Violette Noire, pardon my French, Magambo, Palm Springs, Merci pour le Chocolat, Dinner at 8, Bombshell, Jean Harlow, The Pajama Game, Together Again, Redheaded Woman, The Americanization of Emily, Christmas in July, Mucho Mucho Amor, and Christmas in Connecticut. Cassandra writes, Midway with Woody Harrelson, Mandy Moore, and other greats. Emily writes, The Princess Bride. Madeline writes, Eurovision, 310 to Yuma, and Young Guns. Chuck writes, Bottle Shock. Gregory writes, The Untouchables, The Hateful Eight, and The Old Guard. Kim writes, It was grandson week at the summer camp, so we each had a movie pick night. Jumanji Jungle and Jumanji Next Level for Elijah and Jeff. Apollo 13 for me. Aw, thanks, Kim. Tony writes, We did theater on film this week. An all-female Julius Caesar, Indecent, SpongeBob SquarePants the Musical, and a rewatch of Hamilton. James writes, Avengers Affinity War, Curse of Frankenstein, Corridors of Blood, and Greyhound. Maya writes, Ford versus Ferrari, Greyhound, Disclosure, Eurovision, and Pocahontas. Liz writes, The Netflix's Old Soldier, amazing, and I typically hate action films. Liz writes, Juliet. Okay. Chris writes, Rewatch Brokeback Mountain for the first time since seeing it in theaters. Such subtle heartbreak and so much emotion in the silence between Jack and Ennis. The score and the cinematography are just amazing, too. I'll forgive Ang Lee for Billy Lynn's long halftime walk home, I suppose. Also, a quick change, a Bill Murray classic and his only directorial credit. Chris, I'm glad you brought both those up because I remember seeing Brokeback at the Keystone Arts Theater the week they opened. And this week in the AV Club online, the subject matter is films involving Saturday Night Live alum, and they do a nice write-up on Quick Change. Julia Ricci. Hey, Julia. Original cast album Company, the documentary, and watch the documentary now parody Co-op. Good combo there. The Lovebirds and Station West. Sarah writes, The Old Guard. I was so happy to get an action movie with a female lead whose crew wasn't just the five-man band trope where she is the only woman. I agree, Sarah. Kathleen writes, I've mostly been reading. Samuel writes, sometimes I don't read ahead, folks. Samuel writes, The Circle. Interesting look at what it's like to realize you're stuck in the middle of a river and don't like the direction it's going, but then using its power and inevitability against worse outcomes. Ryan writes, The Platform. Julie writes, An Affair to Remember. Jay writes, Watched Bohemian Rhapsody last night, also rewatching Band of Brothers. David writes, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, Godfather 1, and Poltergeist. Tell Joe Beth Williams to call me. Benjamin writes, classic queer coding has been the theme for me. Tea and Sympathy, From Here to Eternity, and Dracula's Daughter. There's a triple bill right there, Benjamin. Brian writes, Hustlers, The Old Guard, and The Fifth Element. Joe writes, Greyhound, The Informer, 1935, and the Denzel Washington version of The Equalizer. Kelly writes, Hamilton, The Guest, Creep, Creep 2, Insomnia, and Meet Me in St. Louis. Jackie writes, Greyhound and Palm Springs. Christian writes, We watched The Old Guard, enjoyed it, and want a TV series out of it. Grace writes, Crip Camp in honor of Disability Pride Month and the 30th anniversary of ADA. That's right. Allison writes, Only loved it, though it was a bit on the nose during the current pandemic. The remake of Last House on the Left, I had to turn it off. It was way too graphic. I don't want to watch the graphic rape of a teenage girl. Understood, Allison. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Hated it. Can't figure out the Oscar noms, but I'm not a Tarantino fan. I am. Sorry. Not really. Anyway, Allison also writes The Old Guard. Enjoyed it. And The Autopsy of Jane Doe. Good. Britt also chimes in. I'm so glad I'm not the only one who yawned our way through Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and I usually like Tarantino movies. Molly writes, An Evening with Beverly Loughlin, Eurovision, Fire Saga, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and Sweetland. Frankie writes, Marriage Story and Waiting for Guffman. Kane writes, I am number four, 2008 Rambo, Identity Thief, and Stuber. Scott writes, both Zombieland films. Laura writes, Room. Janet writes, The Last Movie Star, Our Souls at Night, The Original Stepford Wives, Up in the Air, and Coneheads. Jim writes, Jojo Rabbit and Captain Fantastic. Chris writes, 2005's Idiocracy. I also have to add always, you mean the documentary Idiocracy from Mike Judge. It's all in the timing, folks. Stan writes, Palm Springs, Simon, the new Charlize Theron one. Yeah. Speed 2 and Jojo Rabbit. Rachel writes, Midsummer. And then adds, you know, I watched because I meant to see it in theater forever ago, but I also wanted to watch because of the dress and because she looks vaguely like me. I adore you, dear. Mrs. Holden. That's an inside joke. Anne writes, Knives Out and Little Miss Sunshine. Nice Toni Collette double feature there. Becky writes, I, Tanya, and really enjoyed it. Joel writes, Honey Boy, Vivarium, Killer Joe. Ooh, hope you weren't having chicken while watching Killer Joe. Jay and Silent Bob Reboot and The Goldfinch. Brent writes, Disclosure, the Netflix documentary. Required viewing, he says. Carrie writes, Click and Fried Green Tomatoes. Tom writes, Columbus. Kirk writes, Inside Job, the documentary about the 2008 financial crisis, also The Monuments Men. Abby writes, The Witches, Midsummer, and Million Dollar Baby. William writes, Vice, the film about Dick Cheney. Susan writes, Jaws with riff tracks, hilarious. Good call, Susan. I might see if I can talk Emma into watching Jaws with me with riff tracks treatment. Steven writes, He also tells me what his partner is watching. John watched Particle Fever. We both watched A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. He liked it. I almost went into sugar shock. And also Horton Foote's 1918 with Matthew Broderick. Not enough people have seen 1918. Stephen, and I, of course, gush over Horton Foote whenever possible. Mulveen writes, Queen and Slim. Judy writes, The Last Gold, a documentary about women swimming at the 72 and 76 Olympics when the forced doping of East German swimmers emerged. Britt writes, with her list, Clash of the Titans, the original Clash of the Titans. Jumanji, The Next Level, again. The Old Guard, Mucho Mucho Amor. Frozen 2, Moana. The live-action Lady and the Tramp. Mulan 2, Mission Impossible 4, Ghost Protocol. Jurassic Park 3, Jurassic World, again. The Witches, Life of the Party, and Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. David writes The Lion King. Mike writes More Cinema Novo. Michelle writes Newness. And Gary writes Good Night and Good Luck. And I agree with that. All right, folks. So there you go. That's what you've been watching over the past week. So I hope you took some notes. I hope you check out something that you've not experienced yet, as well as fall back on old titles that are familiar. Cinematic comfort food, nothing wrong with that. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. And go to the drive-in if you can. So hope you're staying safe. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you're staying sane. Hope you're listening to doctors and scientists. And be good to one another, if you would. And we'll chat again. I'll chat to you. You can grab a pencil again next week. We're going to end today's show with a little more music from Lalo Schifrin from the soundtrack Enter the Dragon. This is called Prologue, the First Fight. This is the opening fight scene between Bruce Lee and Sammo Hung. So thanks for listening. Take care, everybody. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!